I'm Hillary.
I'm Emily.
And we're the Sirens.
Today we're discussing the 1962 movie That Touch of Mink, starring Doris Day and Cary Grant. In this movie, on a rainy day in New York City, currently unemployed Kathy Timberlake, played by Day, is furious when a passing limousine splashes her ahead of a job interview. But she changes her tune later that day when she meets the car's passenger, dashing wealthy businessman Philip Shane, played by Grant. They are immediately attracted to each other. Philip is much more experienced than Kathy, and she is unprepared for his proposal that she accompany him immediately to Bermuda, Paris, and Monte Carlo and begin a love affair outside the bounds of marriage.
Outside the bounds of the United States, outside the bounds of marriage. It's
yeah. But it's like, you know, early love bombing, except no love is mentioned. Kathy turns to her streetwise roommate, Connie Emerson, for advice. Once in Bermuda, Kathy's moral ambivalence frustrates Philip, and they repeatedly fail to consummate their relationship. Philip's business associate, Roger, believes that Kathy is just what Philip needs in his life, as he has never needed to work at making a conquest. With the help of Connie and Roger, Kathy devises a plan to make Philip jealous and prompt him to reconsider marriage. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. What I like about that is that it sort of explains the purpose of Roger and Connie in this movie.
So. Yeah, I mean, the real purpose of them is just comic relief, I think.
Yeah, I want to dig deeper into their purpose because at some point I was like, Roger in particular, I was like, this movie could be so many other things without this guy.
Yeah, that the Roger character in particular, I thought there was way too much of. Like, Connie, I was kind of okay with.
Yeah, for sure.
And it made more sense because they were roommates that she would be around so much, but
yeah,
but less so with Roger.
Yeah, this like financial advisor who, yeah, we can get into him a little bit more.
This segues nicely into some trivia. Because Gig Young, who played Roger, was a chronic alcoholic. That was more tolerated at the time that this film was made, but all of his slurring and sloppy mannerisms in the line delivery are actually just the hit. He was actually drunk for all of those scenes. He's not acting.
That makes the like the drinking at 9 a.m. less funny.
I know, but apparently like people were just like, ha ha ha, look at this adorable alcoholic. Like, no, you know, it wasn't considered.
Must be nice to be a white guy.
I know. But I did read that like later in his career, it did negatively impact him as he got worse and worse, and he started to get fired and lose roles because of it.
Yes, and eventually died in a murder-suicide.
Oh, I didn't get there. Oh, yeah, I did not know that part.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
Was he murdered or was he the murderer?
He was the murderer.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to go look this up or if I want to spare myself from looking this up later.
Well, it was a long time ago, so.
Okay. Additional trivia. So when I was watching, I was like, are these the real Yankees? And then yes, it was the real Yogi Berra, Mickey Mantle, and Roger Maris. And apparently Cary Grant was a huge fan, which helped make it easier for producers to get them to appear in the film as themselves.
If Cary Grant ever said, I want X, I would, and I was in the position to make it happen, I would.
Yes, I agree. Same. So Doris Day was 39 when this film was made, although her character was supposed to be in her 20s, and Cary Grant was 57. So it was considerable age difference. And from what I read, this is one of the films that made him think that he should retire from playing romantic leads because they just kept casting him with much younger women and audiences didn't seem to mind. But when he saw the movies himself, he thought that it seemed ridiculous.
Well, and this movie came out the same year as Charade, and I know that that came up in that movie way because that was our first movie that we talked about, and I remember that there was some trivia around that he was like, "I'm old enough to be Audrey Hepburn's dad."
Yeah, and I remember with that movie, they actually kind of rewrote some of the script so that
Right.
so it wouldn't be as creepy.
Yeah. I read somewhere some critic referred to Doris Day in this movie as the world's oldest virgin,
Oh gosh.
because that's like the thing in this movie is that like, she's maybe not a virgin, but like she's like uptight and she's like, I'm not sure if I'm ready to like have sex with this guy or whatever that I just met 24 hours ago. And so it's interesting to hear that she was 39.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why they had to make it like she was a girl in her 20s. I think the movie works just as well if she's in her 30s.
Yeah, I didn't even think about her being in her 20s. I thought about her as being maybe in her like early 30s or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll have to get into it, but I mean, I guess audiences at the time might have thought like she's frigid or like what's wrong with her, but I think there are probably a lot of reasons for her to be uncomfortable in that scenario. And yeah, the movie played it like she was the problem.
Yeah, I have questions about this. This is one of my questions for you.
Yeah, I want to like get more into what was going on in her head when we talk about the whole thing. But so final pieces of trivia. So Cary Grant is known for getting like really involved in the details of production of his movies. And for this one, he brought his own books to the set to populate Philip Shane's library so it would feel like more like his own library. And he also personally chose a raincoat from a women's fashion ad for Doris Day's character, which I thought, and apparently he like called the fashion designer himself and they thought that it was a prank because he like made all his own phone calls and stuff. Then he had to like go down in person and they were mortified because they thought like no way would Cary Grant be calling some like fashion house.
That's funny. I read that he also personally ordered the car that he drives in Bermuda, that he said saw it
Yes.
in an ad and was like, "Oh, that new Citroën, we need to have."
I like that he took such care about all of that. Like, and you know, wasn't just like show up, say my lines, but actually cared about the movie feeling authentic. So when Roger is showing Kathy the list of potential husbands for her, one of the names on the list is Rock Hudson, who, as we know, was Doris Day's co-star in Pillow Talk, Lover Come Back, and Send Me No Flowers. And he was also the actor originally intended for the Philip Shane role, which I think, like, I don't know, I think that would have had a different feel to it.
Yeah, for sure.
Because there's a, I think there's something slightly different with like a young rich bachelor and then like an old rich bachelor. Like, as Cary Grant was kind of like, you know, padding around his like penthouse and his cardigan, I was like, he just looks like an old man.
I'll take that.
Yeah. Oh, and this is interesting. The opening scene with Doris Day getting splattered by the puddle from a passing New York vehicle is said to have influenced the famous intro of Sex in the City. You know, she it, in her case, it was a bus, but it's very similar. It's like New York, like glamour, Manhattan, and then
And then
thing.
water.
Yeah, which I thought the most unbelievable thing about this movie was actually the fact that somebody whose car splashed a pedestrian would feel some moral obligation to that person because that has happened to me so many times, countless times. And believe me, nobody cares. Nobody cares. Nobody notices. If they notice at all, they're probably laughing. Like, it is not something that people would go out of their way to address.
Yeah, where they're like cringing in their car and they're like, "Oh shoot, I feel terrible," but like no one is gonna like stop or like send their financial advisor with like a $50 bill to like find the girl.
I mean, it's so far the other direction that I actually feel like it is on me as a pedestrian to avoid the edge of the sidewalk.
Right.
when it's raining, and if I get splashed, it is my own fault for being dumb.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
I mean, that tells you where we are in terms of like looking out for each other as people.
Yeah, or it's like, or it's a difference between Philadelphia and New York City, or the difference between, 1962 and 2004.
Yeah, it's probably that. Yeah, because I can't imagine New Yorkers being much more considerate than Philadelphians. But anyhow, so that's my trivia. Do you have a bio for us?
I do. I bio'd Audrey Meadows, who played the friend, Connie, and we hadn't seen her before, but she was well known for The Honeymooners.
Which I
So
have never watched. Have you?
I have never watched either, so I did not recognize her. So she was born Audrey Cotter in New York City in 1922. She was the youngest of four siblings, including the actress Jane Meadows. Her parents were Episcopal missionaries in China, and that's where her three older siblings were born. And then they returned permanently to the United States in 1927 when she was five. And after high school, she got roles on Broadway. She sang in the Broadway musical Top Banana, and then became a regular on the Bob and Ray show on television. And then she was hired pretty quickly to play Alice on the Gla Jackie Gleason show after the actress who originated the role, Pert Kelton, who I know and love from The Music Man, was forced to leave the show due to blacklisting. The show, The Honeymooners, eventually became a half-hour sitcom on CBS, and she continued in the role and continued to play the role for a long time, just in various iterations, including honeymooner specials in the 1970s. She was originally, when she first auditioned for the role, Jackie Gleason turned her down for being too pretty and chic. And so she like re-auditioned for the role with a new like photo where she was like much plainer. She appeared in other television episodes and films outside of The Honeymooners and guest starred in a lot of TV shows, including The Red Skelton Show, Murder, She Wrote eventually, and an episode of The Simpsons eventually. So she worked a lot. She did retire from acting for a while. And during those years when she was retired, she served as the director of the First National Bank of Denver for more than a decade. She was the very first
Oh.
woman to hold this position. Just like a
Yeah.
random other career. She, for another 10 years, she was an advisory director for Continental Airlines, where she was actively involved in marketing programs and consulting on the designs of flight attendant uniforms and aircraft interiors. Like, why? I don't know how she got that job, but she did. She was unfortunately a longtime smoker, and she was diagnosed with lung cancer in 1995. She was given a year to live, and she declined all but palliative care and died on February 3rd, 1996. She was buried at Holy Cross Cemetery in Culver City, next to her second husband. And her headstone has her birth date incorrect. So,
Oh, I thought that she was a good comedian
yeah, I
in
thought
this.
she was a good foil to the other characters.
Yeah, and I did read that people thought it was ironic that she had that line about the only thing women have gotten in all of these years is the right to smoke in public,
Yeah.
and that, then she died of lung cancer.
Yes.
But yeah, I thought she was interesting. I enjoy like comedic women actors, and we don't see as many of them as I would like in these older movies. So
Yeah.
actually, I mean, Doris Day was also pretty funny with some of the faces she was pulling and stuff in this movie.
Yeah, this was, I have a lot of like questions about her care, in particular, and like what the perspective of the movie was on her character. But I thought she was fun to watch, even if I was like,
Yeah.
I'm not really sure what's happening here.
Yeah, I agree. I had questions about her true desires and what she was trying to do in the movie.
Yeah,
So, I
or
mean,
like what she was trying to do, and also like what the argument of the film was about what she was trying to do. Like, was I didn't ever get like a solid read about like whether the film was trying to tell us like she's nervous about these situations and like going to Bermuda and that's okay that she's nervous, or was it making fun of her?
Yeah, so I was confused at, because she kind of went back and forth about the whole. I mean, so she went to Bermuda twice, which was ridiculous. And like the first
Twice in 2 days.
time, twice in 2 days. Yeah, we could talk about the timeline of some of the stuff they did in this movie. So the first time she was like kind of horrified that there was only one bed and kind of freaked out and then didn't sleep with him. But then it seemed like she got mad at herself for not doing it. And then she went back down to try to do it. So I was wondering, like, is her perspective, no, I don't want to do this. I think this is wrong. And I want to be married to like have this kind of a relationship. Or was her perspective like, I'm trying to be more of a new woman and I want to be the kind of person who could just have an affair like this, but she couldn't quite like get herself to do it. I wasn't clear on like where she stood morally on the whole thing.
Well, and I think like when you talk about time, when you add time into that, I think like either one of the those reactions is perfectly, and those like rationale, that rationale for those reactions is perfectly logical and reasonable, given that like this is a guy she met like 24 hours ago. I think it's perfectly reasonable to have any reservations about
Yeah.
anything involving somebody that you just met.
Like to me, it seemed like he came on really strong by just immediately saying, like, come away to another country with me.
Well, like a
And
series of other countries. Like we're gonna go to
yeah.
Bermuda and then we're gonna go to Paris and then we're gonna go to Monte Carlo. Like we're going tomorrow.
It seemed odd. And then so the perspective of the movie was that I guess he was actually kind of a like playboy type who had these kinds of relationships with women. But I didn't like how frustrated he got with her just because, I mean, I know that she was, her behavior was kind of like all over the place, but. And I know I'm looking at this from a contemporary perspective, but like theoretically, she should be able at any point to be like, oh, actually, I'm not comfortable with this. And
It
he should
should
just be
be fine.
like, all right, like, I don't want you to be uncomfortable. Let's take a step back.
Yeah, and I think like in some ways I don't think that he was frustrated in a like morally judgmental way. It was just that like the times when we see him out with other women, which he is, he like comes back from Bermuda and immediately has dinner with another woman, and then he gets a call at the restaurant and it's that he's out with this woman, and it's Kathy saying like, I'm in Bermuda, you can get here in 2 hours, and he like looks at the other woman and the other woman is like, if I were in your position I would go. And so it seems like he's used to like going out with women who are not about commitment, who are just about having fun, and there's like no judgment there, but it's like he's just not like not used to like dealing with a woman who is like, no, we should get married. Which I didn't read it as a judgment. It was more of a like this is totally different from what I'm used to.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it did seem like that. I mean, this is like a classic movie of this time and also very Doris Day movie type of trope that she saw him and just like immediately fell in love with him and was just kind of like a dope. And it was just like, oh, whatever the woman thinks just kind of goes out the window and she just can't help herself. Like with these men, but I still just I don't know. I had a hard time figuring out like basically the whole movie was about like whether or not she was gonna sleep with him. It was like the entire movie.
I appreciate that what we see of her in the first part is when she's going to the unemployment office and she has to deal with this Beasley guy who is like terrible and is just like disgusting. And she handles him beautifully and is just like, she's like, I'm not interested in you. You're disgusting. I'm not gonna shy away from like saying no to you and like putting you in your place. And so on the one hand, we like that's the first thing we see about her, that's like how she treats men that she's not interested in, which I think is great. And so like the I contrast then when she treats Philip Shane in an entirely different way. You're like, okay, this is an entirely different. She's interested in him, and he's interested in her, and is not like a creep in the way that like Beasley's a creep, and so she's like, it's like center in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seemed like this was a situation where there was a huge power imbalance, and like he's this rich, powerful man. Their first date is like a 20-hour date where he takes her to multiple different cities
That's right. And a Yankees game.
at a Yankees game where they sit in the dugout and they go to like a UN council hearing or.
Yeah, they're in Baltimore, Philadelphia, and then at a Yankees game.
Yeah, and they take like his private plane, and the whole thing is just insane. And it's very clear that like they are interested in each other, but like it's presented as that the relationship can only be on his terms, which is like, I'm not interested in marriage. Like, I'll take care of you. It's kind of like old school seduction. Like, he whisks her away to this fabulous hotel in Bermuda. And
Yeah.
it's not like he like immediately tries to have sex with her. Like they kind of have this great day and do all kinds of different glamorous activities, but it's still like he's in control. Like he controls where they go, what they do. He's
Yeah.
paying for everything and he decides what the relationship is.
Right. But do you think, but ultimately, she's the one who's in control, because ultimately, like, she doesn't have sex with him against her will. She goes home when she wants to go home. She like makes him pursue her, both like in a positive sense, I guess, like at first, and then like with the whole like trip to New Jersey, Asbury Park with Beasley to like try and get him to come after her. So like in the end, he is forced to follow her terms. Like in the end, they do get married.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess that's the ultimate switch is that she kind of regains the power. I laughed out loud in the movie where, you know, he kind of carries her off from the hotel and then he has the cream on his face like he's nervous. And then it cuts to the next scene where they have a baby. And it just seemed so ridiculous that like this whole movie is about like, are they gonna have sex? Are they not gonna have sex? And then like they skip over the whole part where they actually do consummate the relationship, and then there's just a baby there.
Well, and like he even when he like is picking her up from as from New Jersey and puts her in the back of the poultry truck, he's like, you know, and she's like, well, you know, what if I'm still too scared to have sex or whatever? And he's like, well, let's have like three or four children and then maybe you'll feel better.
Well, I do think I don't often find myself feeling like I relate to anything from these kinds of movies, like from this period. But like, there was something about this that I found relatable. Just like the feeling of being in a situation, in a romantic situation where like you do like the person, but you don't maybe necessarily want to take that step, and how it can put you in such an awkward position because you almost like feel obligated and you're like, well, I am attracted to this person, but like I'm feeling some pressure from this situation, and like how do I get out of it and in any kind of way that's like graceful, and there is no graceful way to do it, and then you just end up like looking really foolish. I don't know, like that whole
Falling off the
thing.
balcony onto the canopy and breaking your arm.
Oh yeah, I love the part where she had the liquor bottle on her toe. That
Although
was
like I
great.
felt like I saw that she drank the entire bottle by herself, and I felt like I had like an empathetic or a sympathetic like migraine immediately.
Oh yeah, Mike and I were both like, this lady is gonna need to go have her stomach pumped.
No,
Like,
no.
but that, I don't know, that is a real thing. Just like that feeling of like pressure and obligation, even if it is someone you like, and like there's not a good way to navigate that. Perspective of the movie, I felt like was just kind of making fun of that or saying like there's something wrong with those people. You know, obviously it was a male perspective.
Yeah. So speaking of making fun of things in a male perspective, can we talk about Roger a little bit?
Oh my gosh, I don't even know what to say about him.
So he's in therapy with a psychoanalyst that he like calls all the time. And you kind of get the sense of like, well, you know, like what is this relationship with the psychoanalyst who's like telling him all these things? And he's like being very, very forthcoming with Philip about like the things that Dr. Gerber is telling him. You know, we see finally see the scene where he's with Dr. Gerber, and the first question Dr. Gerber asks him is, you know, how are the markets or whatever? And
Yeah.
without thinking, Roger is like, well, here, like basically, like here's some market advice that like he's not paying attention to like that, the reaction to that. But we see that Dr. Gerber sneaks out of the room while he's like launches into his story, and he goes to call his broker, I guess, to like take that advice and immediately act on it. I think we're meant to see him as like unscrupulous. And then he like comes back into the room and he's missed all the context of the story of Kathy and Philip. And so then what the part that he hears and what he puts together from what he hears, he thinks that Roger is having an affair with Philip and is sort of like shocked by the, but not like scandalized, I don't think, by the idea that, you know, that this guy would be like considering having a relationship with this other guy. But he is a little bit like his response then is to like sneak out again and tell his like broker, like, never mind, this guy's like off his rocker, basically. So, like, because in his mind, as a psychoanalyst or whatever, like, if you're gay, you're crazy, you know, or that you like have a mental illness, which was, you know, I meant to look up before this when homosexuality was taken out of the DSM. And that misunderstanding becomes a joke in this movie to the point that the very last scene, when they have the baby, Philip is like watching the baby for a moment, and Dr. Gerber comes up and is like, oh, you know, how basically, like, how did things turn out? And Roger's like, oh, this is how it turned out. There's a baby. And Dr. Gerber is like, oh, like his understanding of it is like clearly that these two men had a baby together. And that's supposed to be sort of funny. So my question is, like, are we supposed to be in on that joke in a way that is like, two men being together is like totally, utterly ridiculous and scandalous, something to laugh at? Or are we in on the joke in that, like, we see that Dr. Gerber just totally doesn't understand what's going on, and he's ridiculous for thinking that, like, Philip and Roger are together? Essentially, like, is this movie homophobic
Oh, it's definitely
or
homophobic. I
is
wrote in my notes like very anti-gay, underlined exclamation point. Both are true.
Yeah.
But well, I think actually that the perspective of the movie, similar to like some other movies of this time, is just that fad, like quote unquote fad of like going to analysts is stupid.
Yeah.
And like, so it's just kind of a joke. Like it reminded me of in another movie. Oh, when we watched Miracle on 34th Street,
Oh,
there was
right.
that like analyst who worked for Macy's for some reason. And he would just like make some kid keep coming to him and tell him that he had like make him believe he had issues
Right.
about his father. But I mean, that was a different decade that that movie came out. But anyway, I still think that there was a lot of public belief. And yeah, I like I this same attitude was in a show that came out like a couple years ago. Like the therapy is for jokers and this is all just nonsense.
Yeah.
That was my take on it, but also that it is very homophobic.
Yeah.
I think it's both. It's both the analyst is terrible and, you know, they're bigots,
Yeah.
basically.
And also, it's anti-therapy for good reasons in this case, and anti-gay.
Yes, I think that it's both. Although then part of me, like as you were talking, I was like, I wonder, I feel like if you looked at it through a more contemporary lens, you know, maybe like queering the movie, like I was like, well, Roger was like super involved in this guy's love life and personal life. You know, could there be a reading where he did have some kind of interest in him? But I don't know. I mean, I didn't think that when I was actually watching it.
Well, and it also, I mean, the other thing that's interesting to me is that, like, and I would be curious to know more about who knew what about Rock Hudson when. I don't know this. Like, was it an open secret that Rock Hudson was gay? Like, yes, he was mentioned by name because of the Doris Day Rock Hudson connection. And so that's kind of a sly, like, Doris Day should mention Rock Hudson. You know, with the anti-gay stuff, I'm like, okay, is Rock Hudson on the list because he's a gay guy? There's
Oh,
some,
I thought
like,
you were gonna say, is that part of why he wasn't cast in the role?
well, is that part of why is, I mean, I don't know.
I mean, that's a good question. I do think, like, of all
I mean, I think my
the
understanding is that he wasn't cast in it because they wanted Cary Grant.
Yeah, I mean, like, Rock Hudson is fine and everything, but, like, he's a poor man's Cary Grant. So
Let's be
even when
real,
Cary
everybody
Grant's
is a poor man's
57,
Cary Grant. If you could get Cary Grant, do Cary Grant.
yeah, I do think that, like, of everything that we've watched, well, I don't know. I mean, maybe see if you could come up with another example, but, like, this is the one that the most directly, like, refers to gay relationships, although it's, like, totally played for jokes, but.
Yeah, I mean, what's that? What's the Cary Grant here, Katherine Hepburn movie that we watched?
Oh, where she's, like, gender swapping.
Yeah, and there he like they don't.
Sylvia Scarlett.
That's right. He has feelings for her, but thinks she's a guy.
Yeah, that's true. That was a good example. And I guess, I mean, really, like, you go further back and they're doing more
Bring it
interesting
up.
things.
Bringing up baby, like that's the first time that somebody says, I mean, he goes, I'm going gay all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so how many Cary Grant movies are there where there's a gay undertone is really where this conversation is going.
I mean, worth looking into.
What was that article that I sent you not long ago that was like basically like Cary Grant and Randolph Scott a thing, the definitive story?
Yeah, well, they made a beautiful couple.
Listen.
Well, and, like, beyond all of the, like, this, that sort of, like, dumb comedic through line about the analyst, I still thought Roger was just an annoying character, the way he kept, like, saying, like, I want to quit, but you keep paying me too much. And, like, I want to go back to academia. And I was like, what is wrong with this guy?
Yeah, as if like going to Princeton, working at Princeton, he wasn't gonna get paid like so much money. I know, I was like, cry me a river. Like, I'm sorry you're getting paid $50,000 in 1962. Like,
Yeah,
what is
and it
that?
made no sense. It was like, no one's stopping you. Just, like, you want to leave, just leave. Like,
Yeah.
I mean, I know it was supposed to be funny, but I was like, I don't really get this guy, and I don't understand, like, why he would be an appealing addition to this movie, because he really got a lot of screen time.
Yeah. Well, I guess part of it is that like I didn't really like have a good sense of what Philip Shane's job actually was. And so I was like, why do you need, 'cause it seemed like a, I just looked in the an inflation calculator to see what $50,000 was. If it was in 1962 and 2024, that would be $500,000.
Oh my gosh.
I would be happy to work for Cary Grant for $500,000.
I know.
Not complain about it. Yeah, it wasn't ever really like fully clear to me what Philip Shane's job was because he was both like buying companies and speaking at the UN about developing resources for underdeveloped countries
Oh
for
yeah,
UN.
did you like how he was like, what do you think about untapped resources and developing countries? And she was like, I think we should tap them. And I was like, oh God.
Unconsidered opinion. But yeah, but I was like, what is his job? Like, is he an economic advisor? Is he like, does he own an enormous corporation? And in any of those situations, why do you need a financial advisor? It seems like you are the financial advisor, Cary Grant.
Yeah, that's true.
Why are
That's a
you
good
paying somebody
point.
$500,000 to advise you?
I don't know. I mean, maybe he's, like, one of those self-made, quote unquote, self-made man, like a Warren Buffett type or something.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it seems like he's cast in that type of role a lot. Like,
Oh,
a
right, because
couple of.
in Charade also he worked for the US Treasury.
Yeah, and then what was the one we just watched with, oh, Indiscreet?
Oh, right.
He also somehow was some, like,
Economic guy.
big, yeah, who was
Grenada.
rich And yeah, Nato wanted to use it, but like he's always cast in that role as like this businessman who also has like international government ties. I prefer him as the newspaper editor in His Girl Friday.
That's right.
It just seems like once he got older, they were like, well, how can we make him appealing to these like 3 decades younger women?
And the answer is to make him extremely rich.
Yeah, I mean, can we talk about one of the problems I had with this movie is it really felt like a lot of the appeal of this guy is that it was almost like a Cinderella fantasy that he was just super rich. He would just, whoever was with him, he would just buy them anything. Like, it wasn't even like he was like, oh, I'm just taking you abroad. It was like, I'm buying you like an entirely new wardrobe and like setting you up. You know what I mean? Like that. The perspective of the movie seemed to be like, this is what every woman wants. They want some like super rich dude who's like worldly to come in and just like fulfill this rich person fantasy for them. And I was like, is that what everyone wants?
Well, and then, I mean, so then at some point, like when they've like broken it off, and Kathy's like, I'm getting a job and I'm moving on or whatever, you know, like 3 days later or whatever. She does get a job at a credit card company as a computer person. It's kind of badass. And then she finds out that like actually Philip got her that job, like unbeknownst to her. And so when she finds out about that, she's horrified and embarrassed and is like, no, I can get my own job. Like, and so I appreciate that, like, in that moment, we see the glimmer of the first like version of her where she's like standing up for herself and is like, you know, I can take care of myself, you know, and she like ruins the credit card industry on the Eastern Seaboard in like in an attempt to be like, you know, I actually can take care of myself. I don't need him to like, you know, like get me this job, which I kind of appreciated.
Yeah, that was the Upper Sandusky coming through.
Yeah. Oh my
Like,
God.
I don't
Totally.
need your handout.
Yeah. Girls from Upper Sandusky can do for themselves.
That's true. I did wonder if, so like, say it was still Cary Grant, but he was not this like big rich dude who like speaks at the UN and stuff. And he, you know, they were still mutually attracted. And he was just like, yeah, I'm not interested in marriage, but like, you know, I want us to have an affair. I feel like she wouldn't have even entertained it if he wasn't someone with that much status. Like, I
Although,
think that
but
was
I
part
think,
of the appeal.
well, yeah, but I also think like they had the like mutual attraction was so strong and obvious, like when they meet. I think part of why like she was into it was because she was attracted to him. She was interested in him, and there wouldn't have been any moral ambiguity if she wasn't interested in him. I mean, I think that's what we see with like Beasley, when Beasley's like, oh, come up to my apartment. She's like, absolutely not. No.
Beasley was so gross the way he was like, well, you know, I'm not going to give you your unemployment check if you don't agree to go out with me.
Yeah, or at least agree to have this conversation with me.
Oh, it's the worst. I felt so, it also seemed very quaint that like people were going down to the unemployment office and actually dealing with the real person.
It was very quaint.
I've been living my own life, making my own decisions for a long while now. It's impossible to go back to being treated like a child again.
Do you think we're ready to talk about this movie and the Bechdel test?
Yes. Does it pass
And,
the Bechdel test?
well, are there two women who talk to each other?
Yes.
Do they talk about anything other than a man or a relationship?
I think Connie and Kathy do talk about work, but I think it's in the context of men. She's like, you know, this guy ruined my outfit for my job interview.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it passes. Even though we do have another semi-developed female character.
Yeah. I do appreciate that they do have a lot of conversations together, and I found it
Yeah.
sort of charming the way that their bedroom was set up with their
Oh,
head.
me too.
I was like, that's so cute.
It was really cute. It seemed appealing to me, the idea of like, you know, two adult women being roommates and like trying to make it in New York. Also, the automat was fabulous.
I know.
It really made me want to go to one.
I know. I know.
Not that they exist anymore, but.
We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery.
Well, what about, did you think there was any sort of social justice message?
I mean, I think there was that piece where they were talking about undeveloped countries, that whole conversation about, like, you know, what's the economic opportunity, I guess, of like dealing with undeveloped countries. That is a metaphor for like undeveloped women.
Yeah.
So I think there is that element.
True. I mean, and I don't know if this should be more under Bechdel than like social justice, but it did seem like there was an element of like that the perspective of the movie was, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but that if an unmarried woman did sleep with someone, like it didn't necessarily seem like the movie was saying that that was horrible.
Right. It was basic. I agree. I don't think the movie was saying that was bad. It was sort of like a fact of life.
Yeah. So, you know, for that time in the early 60s, I think that would have been considered somewhat forward thinking.
I read somewhere that like Doris Day movies in particular played a big role in shifting how people thought about premarital sex.
I would believe that because, I mean, that it does seem like a lot of her movies were kind of about that and being like a single woman and how you dealt with those things. But it was more like they were flirting with the line, and then she never actually does. You know, like the resolution of the movie. I mean, it was the same in Pillow Talk. Like, it's her and this ne'er-do-well bachelor, and the resolution is always that they get married, and so the sex is still within the confines of marriage.
Well, they get married and they have a baby.
Oh, yeah. To immediately, like, legitimize everything. I don't know. I mean, I think in general, this movie does not have much of a social justice message. And I think it does a lot to glamorize wealth.
I think you're right. I was thinking a lot about, like, oh, there are a lot of rich white people on this island.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, on the flip side of that, I did think, like, I really enjoyed the style of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like the clothes were really incredible, and like the whole aesthetic was beautiful, and it had that feeling of like a fashion movie. Especially that black dress that Doris Day wore in Bermuda, I was like, whoa. And that, like, just some of the day-to-day stuff, like even Connie had fabulous clothes.
Yeah,
like some of her suits.
Connie had fabulous clothes.
So that's just an aside. But what would you rate this movie?
I maybe like a 3, because there were some things that I liked about it in terms of just like, you know, it's a Doris Day Cary Grant pairing. Like, yes, I will watch that.
Yeah.
And enjoy it. But even with like the point of view of like of the Doris Day character, you know, like sort of making her way in the world, like the sort of anti-gay stuff, like not surprisingly, was not here for it. That's sort of like the dark cloud for me for this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking a 3 for a lot of the same reasons. I thought it was visually a good movie to watch. I thought Doris Day was good in it. But I will say that like when I started, I thought I had never seen this before. And then when I started watching it, I realized that I had tried to watch it a couple years ago and was so frustrated with like the dynamic between Kathy and Philip that I turned it off because I was like, it made me mad. And I felt that way a little bit this time too, and that I needed to get over the hump of like past maybe like the first third of the movie and then just like settle into it a little more, because that whole like her being sort of helpless and being like, well, I'm really into him, so I don't know what to do. Like he wants to sleep together, but I don't want to, but I just can't help it because I'm a lady.
Yeah.
So anyway, but like this time having seen the whole thing, I liked it more than I expected to. So I would give it a 3. So Hillary, what's our next movie?
Ooh, we're totally switching gears. And our next movie is The Lady Banishes.
Yes, I think there will be no... Well, maybe there will be mink coats in this one, but we'll see.
May it please the court, I submit that my entire line of defense is based on the proposition that persons of the female sex should be dealt with before the law as the equals of persons of the male sex.
Follow the Screen Sirens on Twitter at the Screen Sirens.
Leave us a review on iTunes or SoundCloud to help other people find us.
And become a patron at patreon.com/thescreensirens.
Thanks for listening.
After all, tomorrow is another day.